Welcome to Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast brought to you by TPE Network. Let's be about it.
Hello there, Honorverse fans. This is Honorverse Today, the Honor Harrington podcast. This is Raul Ybarra, one of your hosts. And as always, I am joined by my good friends Jim Arrowood and JP Harvey. How are the two of you tonight?
Doing great.
Happy to talk more Honor Harrington.
Yeah, it's amazing how time flies. It almost seems like it was only last week that we talked about Honor Harrington last, doesn't it?
That's so weird.
Imagine that.
Yeah, well, this is the fans already know we had to do a retake of the last book. So
this is going to be a hot podcast. This will be a torch of a podcast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In a way, this kind of is an end point.
As long as somebody doesn't want to torch the podcast.
Yeah. This kind of ends what's almost like a mini trilogy that started with At All Costs, Storm from the Shadows, and now this book. It is also sort of the setup for Mission of Honor, which kind of ends that middle transitional arc that started out with War of Honor. And then we get a little bit of a break from the intensity for a while. So
I don't know if that makes me happy or sad, but
oh, no. I think you'll be happy. Actually, I think you'll be happy. We've got an anthology after Mission. And then I think we start to get into what's called the Tree Cat series. And JP, I know you will like it because Stephanie Harrington has one of the same interests of Honor. And we already noticed this already. That's her interest in firearms.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So we'll have some fun there. Jim, I'm going to let it go to you for some book summary.
Okay. So this is Torture Freedom, Wages of Sin, Book 2 by David Weber and Eric Flint. And from the back of the book, as the slave masters of Mesa plot against the Star Empire of Manticore and the newly liberated slave planet of Torch, Anton Zilwicky and the notorious Havenite secret agent Victor Kashaw set off on a dangerous mission to uncover the truth concerning a wave of mysterious assassinations that have been launched against Manticore and Torch. Most people are sure that the Republic of Haven is behind the assassinations, but Zilwicky and Kashaw suspect others of being the guilty parties. Queen Berry of Torch was one of the targets of the unknown assassins. The former head of the Ballroom Slave Liberation Organization, Jeremy X, now one of Torch's top officials, but still considered by many the most dangerous terrorist in the galaxy, calls in some past favors owed to him. In response, a security officer from Beowulf arrives in Torch to take charge of Queen Berry's security, a task made doubly difficult by the young monarch's resentment of bodyguards and the security officer's own growing attachment to her. Meanwhile, powerful forces in the Solarian League are maneuvering against each other to gain the upper hand in what they all expect to be an explosive crisis that threatens the very existence of the League itself. Well, there it is.
An explosive crisis.
Oh, yeah. Susan Ivanova will be very justified in this book.
Oh, yeah. There's some boom.
All right.
Today all right, and tomorrow, well, all in the same book.
Yeah. I'm going to pass it off to JP.
All right. Mm-hmm. Here's the side notes, the special notes. After this stretch of some very long novels, here we are reading one that feels more like a normal novel in length, even though actually it's still pretty long compared to most novels. This one came in at 609 pages originally. but it is relatively shorter compared to the last several that we read, which were in the 700s. Torch of Freedom was first published in November of 2009. The events in the book take place from late 1919 PD and run into 1922 PD. So again, it covers several years and overlaps events that we've already seen, not redundantly, just like before, but in a way that brings a greater fullness to this significant pivotal part of the Honorverse storyline. After wrestling with how to describe what David is doing here with this technique, I kind of figured the best way to describe it is that he's adding multiple layers to the story, one on top of the other, and I think it's pretty fantastic how he's doing it. Those are the special notes related to the story. There's one nugget that I can throw out there for consideration. Doesn't even have to be for discussion. There's an odd statement made that could be an apparent plot hole in the book that surfaces during a discussion between Ruth and Barry. I'm not sure what everyone else thinks, you guys, but also our friends that are listening. Here was the statement. Technically, I've got dual citizenship now, said Ruth stoutly, so I figure I count as a citizen of Torch, not a Manticoran. That claim was dubious to begin with. While Torch recognized dual citizenship, the Star Kingdom didn't. And that surprised me because our main and most favorite character, I'll claim she's our most favorite character, Honor Harrington herself, might be demonstrating that that is incorrect. She openly and clearly is a dual citizen of both Manticore and Grayson, and she wears the uniform of both navies, and she's a member of the civilian government in both nations. So the only possible contention with this issue, as I remember it, with Honor, I mean, was whether or not she would be allowed to continue to serve in a Royal Manticoran Navy uniform as a commissioned officer, or frankly at all, if she also held citizenship in another nation. The Queen allowed it, as did Grayson, and as things gelled, she also holds commissions in both navies. But that's different. If that's what I'm remembering and it's correct, that's different than saying the Star Kingdom doesn't recognize dual citizenship. So there's that. Maybe it's a good question for David in the next interview.
It doesn't make
the story bad or ugly. It doesn't really change what's happening here in the story, but it was a weird thing that I almost wondered if somehow Eric Flint got worked in there and it didn't get caught by a editor.
I've actually seen this brought up before, and I can give what I believe is the answer to that was
sure
to remember that, yeah, there were special dispensations made in Honor's case. In fact, this had a lot to do with her being created as Countess Harrington by Elizabeth. So it was very special circumstances, and there were legal adjustments made for that particular case.
And that would make sense.
Yep.
You know, otherwise, I don't know. That has to be the only explanation.
Like I said, it's a good thing to bring up because you are not the first person to have noticed this.
But that's it. That is the special notes and the one odd thought that I didn't know where else to fit it, but that they came up, and I'm glad I'm in the good company of others who were surprised by that. Also glad that there's an explanation.
Yeah.
So good, with good that, how about overall impressions? Jim, you want to kick us off?
Oh, I sure will. Okay. This book had too much of everything. I had a difficult time staying with this one for nearly the entire first half of the story. But just for me, there were too many characters, too many places, too many ships, too many words, too much Murray the Explainer, and my brain was about to explode. I was on overload. The second half was a little easier to follow. Overall, I liked the book, but not as much as most of what we've been reading leading up to this. And as I recall, I don't think I cared for the first book in this particular series.
Yeah.
As I normally do. Mm-hmm. I don't hate any of the books, okay? I dearly love them all, but I have my favorites. I'll have a little more in the closing thoughts.
You actually, your too much comment, though, really makes sense, because there were literally three separate stories in this book.
Yeah. It felt like there were a dozen of them. I couldn't keep track. Anyway, let's move it over to JP for his overall impressions.
Huh, you and I are a lot on the same page. So I'm going to start by saying, also didn't hate this, didn't dislike it, but it's not one of my favorites after you saying the last one that we reviewed was, in fact, one of my favorites. After a lot of action and political maneuvering, this book felt slow for all the reasons that you mentioned, Jim. It was dramatic, very noticeable change in pace, except for there was one pretty cool battle scene in here that stood out to me. Not that it all has to be battle all the time. You all know it. I geek out on the politics and the diplomacy, but so given what I mentioned about the importance of the last book, or not what I mentioned, but what we mentioned, and that, Storm from the Shadows, in terms of it bringing multiple subordinate story arcs together and then pivoting us with the larger story arc, this book felt like it was a huge fresh round of world building, or maybe we could call it significant world filling in. And it's already an immense universe. And so that's sort of how I sorted out the too much, as you put it, Jim. In my own mind, it was a lot, and that's okay. But it made me feel like a slower and longer, it made this whole thing feel, made me feel like I was reading really slow, even though I wasn't. And even though the book was 100 to 200 pages shorter than some of the more recent ones, it just felt long. I suspect that some of that feel of the book might reflect the writing partnership with Eric Flint. Can't say for sure, but it's a noticeably different book than the Weber-only ones. Again, don't get me wrong. Liked it. I liked this book, but I had to take the mental position that we're getting a bunch more development. Probably, I'm going to assume that we're going to need in later novels. So I'm trusting that we'll see the benefit of all of this in this book down the road as the story swings. If I'm wrong, then I'll risk angering some fellow fans, I suspect, if they're fans of this book, by saying that maybe it could have been a little shorter. Raul.
Wow. Okay. I find it interesting that we put our notes in without reading where each other's going. This book is a huge shift from where we've been reading. We've got the parallels with what has happened on Torch in the past. We have all the development in the Mayan sector with a more positive, good side, if you want to call it, of the OFS. We have pitched battles with the two of these against the alignment. But much of the book is focused on the much, much slower espionage side of the story that is sort of the Crown of Slaves focus with the quote-unquote super spies Anton Zilwicki and Victor Kasha. And as a result, the pace tends to be much, much slower than what we've had in the past several books in particular. That said, we've got a lot of things that are coming at us in this book from earlier threads that are being closed off. And a lot of new branches of story for the future are being opened. So, yeah, it's a lot of plot setting and world building, exactly like you theorized. This is sort of that slow side of the reset that is juxtaposed against that breakneck pace that we had in the last book. There is one part that I kind of found annoying at times. I think this might be a Flintism, as it were. And that's some of the silliness that could slip in. Things like the Bootree Clan and their amusement park, for example, sometimes got a little annoying. And some of the running gags got a bit stale at points.
And those are some of the things that kept me in this book.
Mm-hmm. There's something entirely here for possible. Everyone.
Yeah, something yeah. for everyone. But that said, it's not a bad book by any means. It's just a very dense and very, very expositional book. Story, though in some ways, in spite of what Jim says, Murray the Explainer was much better disguised than in some of the previous books. But there's a lot more of Murray. In fact, Jim, there's a lot more Murray than you might realize.
Oh, there's tons. I know there's tons in there because it's buried in the dialogue.
Yep.
Oh, it's also buried in a lot of the action too, though.
We get just sitting around and talking and talking and talking and talking for pages and pages.
But it's not the kind of talking that we've had in the conference rooms. It's the kind of talking that is base exposition.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. It's a different kind of and talk, and they talked.
Yeah.
But even a lot of the action, even a lot of the plot was actually very embedded, very imbued with exposition.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll understand as the stories unfold.
Okay. All right.
So,
Raul, you can lead us on discussion of characters, those I can remember.
So these are the people that were talking about all the talking.
Yes.
Exactly. Characters. Okay. The good news is there's a lot fewer characters listed than in some of our previous books. The bad news is half of 1,000 is still 500.
Still a big number.
Yeah. I am going to run down the character list and kind of just provide an overall context and batches so we don't have 45 minutes just going down characters. I'm absolutely 100% certain I'm going to miss someone's favorite character here. I've said that before, and that's going to be even more true now.
As always, our friends out there need to tell us when we miss somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're not story omniscient, so there are facets and elements that we really do hope that our friends out there listening roll in through social media or wherever and say, I really love this character or this part. You guys didn't get to cover it, but that's all a part of the cool dialogue, is we're all just a bunch of fans. Really.
That's where we get the advantage of having so much of our feedback.
Yes.
Well, of course, Anton Zilwicki and Victor Kasha are the two Torch side main characters of the story.
Hey, you know, Jim mentioned earlier that some of the comedy, the silliness, kept him in the story. These mm-hmm. two guys are my anchor points in this book.
Same here.
I love this pair of characters
mm-hmm.
because they should not be working together, and they work together in the stories, and they're working together.
Yep.
I couldn't
but as
agree
characters,
more.
They work together.
Absolutely.
Love
and
it.
Frankly, the banter and silliness that goes on between those two, I absolutely loved.
Yeah. You know, Anton seems to bring out a more human side of Victor Kasha.
Yes.
Yes.
And I almost even like the guy. Still realizing how ruthless he is.
Yeah.
He became much more likable in this book.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a continuing process. They were aided in this by another Torch person by the name of Yana, one of the ex-Scrags.
Mm-hmm.
Barry and Ruth actually have prominent roles, but in a lot of ways, they're secondary.
I love these two. Anytime, anywhere, these two are just amazing characters.
I agree. I agree. I've known people like Ruth.
Mm.
Absolutely brilliant, but sometimes they've got the common sense of a fern. We do see Lara back one last time, and boy, in fact, we get that whole scene replayed with Lara and Saburo.
Saburo, yeah.
Yeah. Saburo is going to be back too, and yeah, I think you'll like where he goes. And then a whole lot more depth with Harper S. Ferry, Van Hale, and Genghis, and that extra depth just made their story all the sadder.
Yeah.
We get some new characters tossed in. Hugh Arai from Beowulf, who seems to be a potential romantic interest for Barry, mm-hmm. even though there's a little bit of age difference there.
Yeah. 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 Almost uncomfortable difference, but it's not hideous. So
yep.
It's.
I get the, what is it? Is she listed as, there's a couple different age references, and I thought she was around 20 at the point.
I think, I was going to say younger.
It might be 18
or 20,
but there's some time lapsing going on, and Jeremy is going out of his way to try and encourage, if not outright manipulate, the interest.
Right. Well, yes. That's Jeremy.
Yep, that's Jeremy. Alfrida Boutre, also known as Granny L.
Granny, yeah.
I just said I found the whole Parmley a lot of the Parmley Station stuff really annoying. Granny L, however, is not included there. I really, really like that character.
Yeah, she was cool.
She is cool, and we will be seeing more of her. From her clan, I also need to mention Bryce Miller, our hormonal teenaged boy.
Yes. Poor guy.
I wish I could criticize him and his priorities, but I was his age once as well.
Oh, he was very well written. I mean,
yeah.
You know, hey, I like that girl. And then he sees one and who happens
the
to
the world have... is literally blowing up around you, yeah. And the entire world stops because of a pretty face.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he sees Barry and they, oh, wow, I could really like her. And then Ruth walks in with a little bit larger chest and it's, oh, I like that one. It's
like, you wish it wasn't quite as accurate, to be honest. But like I said, I was a 14-year-old boy at one time, too.
Hey, you know, what can you do?
The price of a Y chromosome.
Yep. Apparently, David and or Eric were also, at some point...
the same age.
Young men, you know, in the throes of puberty.
Really?
And here uh-huh. is this awesome character. Like I said when you mentioned his name, yep. Poor guy.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what's happening around him.
Mm-hmm. The one more member from the Boutre clan that I want to mention is Andrew Artlett. And we are definitely going to be seeing more of him. Another good character. Sadly, a little too old for Prolong, which kind of actually hits Granny L hardest because she is Prolong and her grandkids and nieces and nephews, a lot of them aren't. And a big deal is the way she negotiates to make sure that they have access to it.
Mm-hmm.
But Andrew, their engineering guru, is a great character that we'll be seeing more of. Let's shift over to the Mayan sector. We have the sector governor or representative from the OFS, Orville Barragos. So not everyone connected with the OFS is absolute slime balls.
Yeah.
he's trying to do, he's ambitious. Yeah, he's got an agenda, but he seems to have an agenda for the right reasons and the right objectives. It's sort of, I'm going after power, but I'm going after power because I can do what needs to be done. Of course, his partner in crime to a large degree is Luis Razak, another very ambitious character. You know, at first he's not the most, and I'm going back to the last book, in fact, not the most likable guy in the Honorverse. And I said, wait and see. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of development with this guy, and we see a whole lot of that here. They've definitely got their own plans, and they've got their own way of wanting to do something about the Salarian League. We get a new person of his inner circle introduced, Dirk Steven Comstra, sort of his flag captain. Edie Habib is back as his chief of staff, and you continue to like her. And Jiri Watanaponzi. Jiri Watanaponzi. And I was going to say the main reason I'm including him in the list is because I can say the name. This brings us over to the dark side. And you know, I know I haven't mentioned Honor or that meeting up again, which did reoccur, but we've still got Albrecht Detweiler and his sons, Benjamin and Colin, the later of which is very lucky to be alive.
Repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat.
Well, they're not introduced, but the characters are a lot more developed in this case.
No. I'm talking about their origin.
clone.
Yes.
Clone. Yeah.
Clones.
Yep. Send in the one of the nice.
Yep, and actually, that should be a theme. Maybe to discuss later. What is a person? Because that is an important part of the whole whole Crown of Slaves Mason alignment. What is a person?
That would only be a 6-hour episode.
but it's a major theme, and it's going to be a major driver of Crown of Slaves.
To be completely honest, I do not feel qualified to enter a discussion like that. I have opinions, but that doesn't make it right.
Oh, I absolutely agree there.
Yeah.
Because one of the things, and one of the reasons I bring this up now is one of the plot points in this book, and I didn't list it as one of my favorites, so I could have, was there's not that much difference between the star lines, you know, the alpha, beta, gammas of the Mason elites and the genetic slaves themselves.
Yeah.
In fact, the genetic slaves are really just sort of the experimental line for what they're going to engineer into the star lines.
Yep.
So, that's where that whole discussion can come up. We get a lot of development on Isabella Bartisano, too. And then they kill her.
Yep.
In a way, I'm kind of sorry to see her go. She's a fantastic antagonist in the story. But the flip side is we still have Anisimovna around.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a little redundancy sometimes isn't necessarily a bad thing. Lajos Irvine has to get mentioned as the last of the bad guys. He's the deep agent that blows the cover on McBride and the torches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He fortunately doesn't have quite enough information to put everything together, but he flags enough to be concerned and brings it up to Isabel. That brings us, mentioning McBride, Jack McBride. His journey is a key part of the Mason side of this story. And I think in a way his soul is too tainted to really survive, as it were. And well, of course, that's exactly what happens. I do need to mention his brother, Zach, just as a future reference. And then there's the first domino of the cracks for the alignment, and that's Erlander Simoas, who actually defects outright.
And not,
keep in mind,
not a happy defection as we view this universe for this guy. Awesome. But this is not a happy story.
No.
This is a tragedy, this guy.
But his problem is what makes Jack reconsider, and it goes into another one of the theme, what I think is one of the big themes that the Crown of Slaves will get into or gets into. And that, the idea of when you're talking about things like social engineering, genetic engineering, theory is one thing, reality is something else.
Yeah.
Jürgen Dusek, Mason crime lord, we're going to be seeing more of him. He's more on the periphery this time. We see more of his assistant, Triu Chunlai. Then there is Steph Turner, another new character that we will be seeing some more of as well, particularly since there seems to be some interest between her and Andrew that I just mentioned. Carl Hansen, the Seki underground leader, another sad case.
Yeah.
And then there's the idiot, David Pritchard.
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't call him an underground or insurrectionist or anything like that. He's a flat-out terrorist. Not only that, his little personal statement really screwed the movement, enough that you're sitting there questioning whether or not they'll be able to regroup. Then the People's Navy in Exile. There's really only two that I'm going to mention here, though there's quite a few that make an appearance, the important ones. Obviously, Adrian Luff. And I'm trying to think, did we see this character before? I thought we had.
I don't remember for sure.
But the People's Navy in Exile, we've definitely seen before.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yep. And I think we kind of put an end to it here in this book. Mm. And then Gawain Madoc, who's an undercover for the Mason Alignment Navy, which is undercover or dark organization, that is disguised as the Mesa System Navy, who is, layers of the onion here, who is Mesa's or Manpower's liaison to Luff. I'm bringing him up mostly because we're seeing them both go through the moral justification, the moral twisting, actually, to justify destroying a planet of millions of people. Anyone you guys want to add, or can I move on to the places and things and organizations? Because those are actually the more important.
I'm okay for you to move on.
Go for it.
All right. Obviously, Torch, that's the main locale for the, quote, good guys, unquote, of the saga. The big thing is that we get a much more in-depth replay of the events related in the earlier books. And we get a good view of how Barry is taking on her responsibilities, and more importantly, how Torch is reacting towards her. And the short end of that is they love her. And in fact, they're cheering the security measures that get imposed on her after the assassination attempt.
Yeah.
Smoking Frog, the capital for the Mayan sector. The Mayan sector and Smoking Frog, they largely represent the positive side of what the League stands for and what the League's original intent, and largely trying to do the right things. I'm saying this because this is part of the setup of a big part of the future of the story. And the movers and shakers on Smoking Frog definitely have their own plan and agenda. They're building their own navy. They're basically, it's almost like they're setting themselves up to tell the Solarian League to go blow off. The Mason alignment at the core of the onion, and this goes into one of the, that second theme, we're seeing some fracture lines starting to form within the line, within the alignment itself, as the players come to face the real meaning and implications of what the modern embodiment of the alignment actually represents, especially with the long-range planning board. And gee, how has it deviated from what Leonard Detweiler originally thought 600 years ago? So there's some cracks and fractures forming there. We get to Mesa. Actually, we learn the general population in Mesa is almost as much in the dark as to the realities of the alignment as the rest of the galaxy. And digging into the Mesa, what's really going to be important are the Sekis, which are the second-class citizens of Mesa. These are the ancestors of slaves that had earned emancipation back when it was possible. This is only like 10% of the Mesan population, but they are going to be extremely important in the future. They're going to be a central part of the story. And of the Sekis, they've got different districts. We are introduced to the first of them. Of the Sekis, we get introduced to the first district, Noya Rostock, which is going to be one of the important districts. There'll be several others that we learn about. Not a lot here, but a lot going forward. We learn a little more about the Streak Drive. Not so much the Spider Drive, but there's another drive, special drive that the Masons alignment has developed called the Streak Drive that can get all the way up into the Kappa bands of Hyper. That's how they're getting messages and people moving back and forth so fast. What's important here is that Samoa was a key part of that project team. So a lot of the technology stuff that Mesa comes up with is probably going to get the beans spilled with this defection. The Biological Survey Corps of Beowulf. What a clever name.
Yes.
Technically, it's an accurate name.
Yeah, we've talked about these guys before very briefly because all we saw was a brief introduction. And now here they are again.
Yes. They're going to have an increasingly important role as that parallels Beowulf's increasing importance. Yeah, then the name is not exactly what it suggests on the surface. Basically, they're the Beowulf secret anti-Mesa, anti-slavery task force. So it's biologically oriented, and there's a surveying aspect of it. It just leaves out the search and destroy part of their job. Parmley Station. I know, Jim, you liked it. I know, but I still got to ask why. For some reason, it just brings up memories of Millie Ways.
You know what? That popped into my mind also as I read this.
Maybe that's why you liked it too.
I don't know what it was, but it was like, wow, this seems like I've read it before. But
yeah. And Millie Ways came to mind, huh?
Yes, it did. It did.
Minus the talking cow.
Now I'm wondering, but it wasn't all silliness though. There was some
No, it wasn't.
There was some gruesome stuff taking place there.
Mm-hmm. You are right. You are right. In fact, the fact that it's an amusement park or a defunct amusement park kind of makes the contrast there really kind of stark.
Yeah.
Which actually might have been the point. That might have been the why to it.
Well, see, and that's what I'm wondering, if we didn't intend to have this seem like Millie Ways, or it seem like what it is.
Mm-hmm.
A contradiction.
Yeah. Okay, one last mention. It's sort of an honorable mention, and that's the Harvest Joy, the ship, and the whole crew.
Yeah.
From when the seventh wormhole was found, all dead, and which is like, oh gosh, I liked Captain Zachary.
It was a little bit of a gut punch when you hit that part of the book. You're like, what happened?
Mm.
The old, I didn't see it coming kind of thing.
Yep. But that does highlight one last place to mention that isn't necessarily in my notes. There is a somewhere else. Let's not forget that. It's going to matter.
Okay. Yep.
Oh, Lord.
All right. So we were about to go into discussions of the story.
Correct. In fact, okay. I had just made the comment to pass it to you, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, following a lengthy rehashing of events from previous books, and that's not a criticism, it is a fact. And again, we got a lot more in depth from that. We move on. Anton Zilwicki and Victor Kashaw work undercover on the planet Mesa to discover the truth behind Manpower Incorporated's operations in Manticore and Torch. In the meantime, the Mason alignment sends a rogue force consisting of former state security forces calling themselves the People's Navy in exile to attack the Star Kingdom of Torch. Their mission is to overwhelm any forces guarding the planet and destroy all life on the surface using a kinetic bombardment. When Rear Admiral Louise Rozak, commander of the Solarian League's Navy's Maya Sector Detachment, learns of the attack and departs for Torch with the intention of defending the planet.
Yeah.
Comments?
Like I said, I like Rozak more and more every time I see him.
Okay.
They're tight with Arohan, too.
That action, that anticipated, proposed, planned, whatever, action to bombard Torch is a significant enough thing that it is an internationally illegal maneuver.
Yeah, it's a violation of the Eridani edict.
Eridani, yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not just a little miffed that, well, what an annoying thing, and this isn't deserved. This is a massive crime that's about to be committed.
It's one of the few things that will get the entire Solarian League united, except the people doing the attack in this case aren't part of a Star Nation.
Right. Harkens back to our discussion last time.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hugh Arai, a former slave and commando for the Beowulf and Biological Surveys Corporation, visits Parme Station, an orbital amusement park run by the Butri clan, descendants of the park's creator. The BSC and the clan agree to turn the station into a secret fortress for the anti-slavery effort. In return, all clan members still young enough will receive prolonged treatments. I would like to get prolonged treatments.
Yeah.
I'm probably a little too old.
Yeah, I think 25 is the age limit.
Oh, bummer.
Dang it, Jim, you missed it by a year.
Yeah, I missed that by a week or two, huh? All right.
Yep.
Anton and Victor make contact with Jack McBride, a Mason security chief who has become disillusioned after witnessing how his friend, Dr. Herlander Simois, has been treated by McBride's superiors. Simois' adoptive daughter was put to death when it was determined she was a failed part of the long-range planning board's breeding programs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the part I was talking about, the cracks starting to form within the alignment.
Yeah.
As they get to the end game.
Yeah, this was one of my favorite parts of the book.
It was fantastic.
Yep.
It was one of mine as well.
Yeah. All right. Hugh arrives on Torch after a Mason planned attempt on Queen Berry's life and becomes her security chief and bodyguard. After a rough start, they begin to realize they have a mutual attraction to each other. In honor of Lara, one of the Amazons killed during the assassination attempt, the newly founded Torch Royal Guard is to be called Lara's Own Regiment.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was nice.
It was.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I kind of like this storyline with...
It was actually a repeat of what we had seen before,
yeah,
but with a whole lot more depth and a whole lot more impact. This
yeah.
was another one of those cases where the repetition, the retelling, added whole layers of context.
Yeah, I was rooting for them to get together.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Anton and Victor work with the Slave Underground and the Audubon Ballroom to get Simois off the planet on a freighter controlled by the clan. McBride, who was to go along with them, winds up being trapped and activates self-destruction charges in the Gamma Center, a secret underground facility where Simois used to work. Along with that, another nuclear device is activated by Seki terrorists. It levels part of the city of Green Pines, killing a large number of people, including Isabel Bardisano, and destroys large parts of Mason's genetic identification records.
To clarify, Isabel was actually in Gamma Center when it blew.
Oh, I see. Okay.
She was part of that nuclear... She was part of that nuclear blast.
Well, she's still just as dead.
She's still just as dead.
Or vaporized, as the case may right. be. All right, so the attack on Torch is stopped by Admiral Mrozak's light cruiser squadron, but the Battle of Torch has cost him most of his ships. He and his surviving crew are afforded a hero's welcome on Torch, while the remaining ex-Havenite mercenaries are imprisoned on an island surrounded by deadly marine predators, so there is no need for a security contingent there.
That battle was a literal gut punch.
Yeah, that was a tough one.
Well, and I think I'm going to bring that up. I'm going to peek ahead real quick to see if I have it. Yeah, this is one of my favorite plot points items, so I'm going to hold off my comments until there.
Okay. And finally, the captured ships of the People's Navy in exile are given to the Royal Torch Navy. Queen Berry and Hugh become romantically involved. Elfrida Boutry, leader of the clan, tells Victor that his days as a spy are over, and he will have a future he can barely imagine because all the universe will know his name.
That was a good scene.
Yes.
It was. So.
Like I said, I like her.
Yeah.
I can't remember if you mentioned it, Jim, but when all the bombing happened, that wrecked a huge amount of Mesa's genetic ID, their identification records.
Yes, it did.
Yeah. I like the comment where it's like Jeremy X could walk down the street of Mendel and no one would recognize him.
Right.
No one would be able to identify him unless they had seen him visibly and managed to survive.
Yeah.
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 I'll tell you what, though. Victor, he doesn't want to accept that. That's the kind of publicity that he does not want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he is at a point he can't avoid it.
Yeah.
Or at least it seems that way. And I want to think it's going to be fun to watch the crisis that happens in his life as he realizes just what Elfride right? What she told him. It's like, let's just be clear about this. Your spy days are done.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Victor is really one of the better anti-heroes that I've come across.
Well, and I think I know we'll see him going forward. It'll be even more interesting now to see his character development as time goes on.
It's going to be a very, very interesting shift in relationships, especially when we hit Mission of Honor.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, when, you know, reinforcing the earlier discussion that we had, you know, this guy, Victor, has gone from being a baddie to being a guy you can kind of like.
And you but you can't help it.
It's like I don't want to know more about him because I'm kind of liking the guy. Yeah. Because I had very strong opinions about him, you know, many books back when we were watching him be himself, do the things he does, what he's paid to do. And he's, you know, just gross, disgusting guy. And David and Eric here they are making this guy somebody that you know enough about that he's got depth and you go, wait a second, he might not be the totally hideous person that we thought
more
he was.
More importantly, they let him grow.
Yeah.
They actually let him grow.
Yeah.
And most importantly, they do something that you don't see a lot of these days. There's absolutely no apology from them for where they start Victor, what he is, and the path he takes.
Yeah. You know, it actually kind of brings to mind this guy's storyline. It makes me think about Clockwork Orange, you know, where Malcolm McDowell's character starts out, he's hateful, he's horrible, you know, and just does all this ultra violence. And then they take him and they give him those treatments and they turn him into a person that all in a matter of 45 minutes to hour and a half, you feel sorry for this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he gets turned back into being what he was before, you feel triumphant. You know, and you can't help it. So, yeah. I'm just going to pass it over to JP for a discussion of themes.
Okay. We've got diplomacy and politics, which we knew was coming. In this case, it's mostly revolving around our growing understanding of this Mason alignment and what they're about, not just the names of the perpetrators. We're watching more and more revealed about who they're manipulating and who they have manipulated and what their grand strategy appears to be. Also, their boldness in their plan to violate the Eridani Edict, which we were talking about just a few minutes ago. And effectively, literally destroy Torch, but they're doing it through arguably surrogate forces, right? The People's Navy in Exile and all that. No surprise that they're manipulating circumstances the way they are, because we've been told that that's what they've been doing. But we're seeing where those tentacles are spidering out to, and still don't really know what's the real. I'm going to caveat this, but we don't really know what is the real plan here. The ultimate goal, we can speculate and all that. But these are some diabolical cats that are
the uplift of man, of course, is the stated goal, but what does that mean?
Yes. So it's interesting. I'm not going to say fun, but it's interesting to watch these bad guys develop. And given how everything else is developed so well in the Honorverse, it's going to be a wild ride, I think, to watch those guys. But back to diplomacy and politics, we're watching yet this other known player become a significant player, not because the story said they're significant, but we're watching their activities. And it's pretty interesting in light of all the other diplomacy and politics that we've been entrenched in for many, many, many books. And speaking of their grand strategy and what they might be up to, the genetic slave trade, again, not a surprise, but it was interesting that in Storm from the Shadows, Rob Pierre was directly, it was a single statement, but he was directly mm-hmm. compared to Hitler by name. And I think we all go, uh-huh. Yeah, could see that.
Yeah.
You know, that's a valid thing, but we've also talked about how he's not necessarily Hitler, because we see a lot of things he's done that other dictatorial or authoritarian,
including his namesake,
people have done. Look at his namesake. So, but well, that direct comparison was made.
It was Oscar that was the
yeah. That guy. Yeah, they're all resting in pieces now, so that's fine.
But, yeah, many pieces.
So these evil designs aren't limited to one man or one nation in the real world, right? Like we're just talking about, you know, it's not just Hitler. It's there's a history of Hitlers out there in the world on large and small scales. But here we see the alignment embracing a very similar view and policy to what Hitler embraced and advocated as things in the story relate to eugenics and their own, what I would argue is sort of their own form of an emerging final solution. What the Detweilers are doing, though, could appear less offensive than what Hitler did or what he tried to do. But I think my caution to myself, and I'll offer it up to my friends out here, is it appears less offensive because the Detweilers they've taken 600 years to quietly move their plan along. They've effectively done it in secret. Mm. We're seeing it now. That is a terrifying load of inertia that's built up there. Mm. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned last time, I think it was in the last show, and then Raul, you actually jumped on it again, as you know, these things like what does it mean to be human? This whole final solution thing, which is not what the Detweilers call it, but this genetic engineering. And I think it was in the last book, they said, well, hey, what's the difference between what happened to genetically alter people as the diaspora was happening? We're genetically altering people for the best chance of success in the environments that we know they're going to be in. Hey, we're not doing anything really different than that. But, you know, again, my statement, my argument, my observation is, I think we all know that this is not that. Something, you know, I smell rotting fish. Don't tell me that the fish isn't rotting. But we don't have the whole picture here yet. So it's just getting ugly and it's getting smelly. And we're seeing, what was the phrase you said earlier, Al? The theory is meeting the practice.
Theory meeting practice. Yeah, yeah, theory meets practice.
Scary. This is the thing that kept me most hooked in this book, as hard as it was to kind of read in the context that we discussed when we kicked the show off.
And this is a big part,
problem,
JP?
Popped when it first surfaced way back in book whatever, 3 or something. It was way early in the series. And we got the hint, not a hint, we got told that there was this genetic slave trade happening, and I made a comment then that this is a big deal, and we've watched this grow, and we've watched the effect of this 600 years of inertia, and you know the Detweilers are moving out of secrecy, I think, to some extent. There's a reason for that, and we don't know what that is. Like, why now? So this is ominous. It's scary. It's exciting. Not exciting in a good way. I'm not making it morally. This is a horrible thing, but wow.
Yeah.
The slave trade.
This is really what you're talking about here, this whole theory meeting practice. It's the whole uplift thing of Leonard Detweiler's is the core part. And what is a person is a big part of it, is one of the big themes here. And I think you've pulled that together nicely here.
And I don't think, I don't know. Because we are, you know, we've talked about this in the last couple episodes. We're about halfway through the total content in the Honorverse. We are quite a ways through the quote unquote main story set of books. But I don't think that David got us to this point to just let us go, well, I guess we got to ponder this on our own. I suspect we're going to get, we're going to get fed a lot more about this problem. The genetic slave trade, well, we just mentioned it, right? What the slave the development of the slaves and their unique capabilities is the playground, the experiment ground, the sandbox for what the Detweilers are ultimately trying to do. And the things that don't work, they're cast aside. The things that do work, they intend to incorporate into, you know, their version of, I'm using the phrase on purpose, their version of a final solution for humanity.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. That is very much, you're really touching on a lot of the themes of the second half of the series, and it's going into the morality of these questions as well. And it's going to dig deep into those.
Not a new statement and not one I originated, right? But one of the great things about science fiction is that you can use it as a tool for social commentary and to explore things that are not polite conversation.
There you go.
And a lot of this is going to get into the, you know, to borrow from another franchise. Everyone's so busy asking if we can do it, no one's asking if we should.
Yeah.
To paraphrase.
So those are the themes. Diplomacy and politics would be the first one, and then the genetic slave trade and all of the slime that is the growing ball of slime that surrounds that specific problem set. So how about, you guys got anything else on that?
No.
I think I'm good. I was going to bring up the what is the purpose, but I think you really covered that very well in your discussion of the genetic slave trade. And it's going to be a big part of what goes forward. So I'd say let's go from there to the plot points with Jim starting us.
All right. So Raul has already panned the silliness in the book, which kind of attracted me, kept moving me forward. I enjoyed the banter between the characters, especially when Queen Berry, don't call me your majesty, Zilwicki of Torch is involved. That will come through in my quote in just a few.
And I don't disagree. I don't necessarily disagree with that.
Okay. And not long ago, someone posted a suggestion that I or we listen to the audiobook versions to get the pronunciation of the character names right. Sorry, that ain't happening. First of all, there's no guarantee that the person who's reading the book is saying the names right to start with. And
I have a comment to add on that when you finish, okay. By the way.
And for the most part, I can figure out how to pronounce names from other cultures fairly well, especially if it's a Germanic language. However, French has always been problematic for me, so I'm grateful that in chapter 21, thanks to Bryce, I finally learned the correct pronunciation for Victor Kasha. Now, if I could just figure out how to say Watanaponzi.
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 I got it this time.
There you go. Anyway, that's...
You want a what?
Yeah, seriously. All right.
All right. Before you go on, just to add, with regard to pronunciations in the audiobooks not being right, keep in mind, one of the big quote-unquote controversies, unquote, of the fandom decades ago is the pronunciation of Manticoran.
Oh, yeah.
The audiobooks...
Oh, I'm fueling that, right? I'm fueling that today on all the shows, right? Yeah, only because
the audiobooks pronounced it Manticoran, which is technically, it should be Manticoran. If we listened to the audiobooks and went with their pronunciations, we would be getting raked over the coals for Manticoran.
Yeah.
And likewise with you in German, I have the advantage of actually, one of my colleagues in Germany, his name is Michael.
Mm-hmm.
I can pronounce that Michael here in the U.S., Michael, if I were going to go with the Hebrew, and three pronunciations that vary idiomatically within Germany of his name.
Oh, yeah.
Three.
There's different dialects there, too. I mean, sure you heard the terms High German and Low German.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And like you, I'm not, my Spanish pronunciations are going to be on the money.
Yeah.
Without even thinking, take a look at my name.
Is it Spain Spanish or Latin American Spanish?
Mm-hmm. well, it's not going to be Castilian. I'm not going to say everything with a lisp. But likewise, my French pronunciations, there's only one thing I can think of listening, and I'm saying this from experience, listening to someone. The one thing that's worse listening to a Frenchman try to speak Spanish is a Hispanic trying to speak French. Boy, if I'm going to butcher pronunciations, it's going to be French.
Oh, well, I'll tell you what. We could sit here and we could discuss languages for the next 4 hours. However, this is not the foreign language
philological
podcast. This is the Honorverse today. And JP is going to now grace us with his favorite.
Oh, geez. Well, my favorite is here is the continuing development for us as readers of the Mason alignment. No surprise, I don't think. Kind of hinted at that when we were talking about themes, but overall it's becoming more common in the story that people see Mesa and Manpower are really more than they seem to be. And we've been talking about that on the show for multiple episodes. So, you know, they're acting like a nation, like a state power, but they're kind of not that. And we're getting to know why. What people are seeing, what we're seeing as readers, is the presence of the alignment under the surface. And now it's a known thing. The tension revolving around the alignment's movement to destroy Torch was a tangent off of that, kind of that favorite. I was, frankly, a little worried that was going to happen. And I was terrified to think we were going to lose all those characters. And was glad that it resolved the way that it did. How about you, Raul?
Okay. One, of course, is going to be, I like the meeting with Honor. It's a very nice repeat that provides another, and I love the way it provides additional layers of context. I kind of like the way that interleaves, and it kind of provides a point of reference to how this book fits into the big whole. Also, like you, and I'm not going to go extensively in it because we've already discussed it a lot, was the Mason alignment development. In particular, the fraying along the party, you know, of the party line, even internally within the alignment, as they're swinging into their endgame. Basically, a lot of the fine words and philosophies start to take on a much more personal impact and meaning for them. And, you know, what I had called before the theory meets reality aspect of it. In particular, the internal working through that goes on with Jack as he finally starts to question what's up and just how far he's willing to go by way of atonement. The defense of Torch is my last one that really falls into one of my favorites. Razak's a favorite character. He comes out almost superficial and a fop who's just pursuing power. But there is so much more depth to him than we realize. And every time we see him, more layers of that get to be peeled off. The battle was hard reading for in some ways, after the kind of fleet actions that we've had, where it's really featuring professional and highly experienced militaries. This wasn't that kind of a battle. It wasn't even a street battle. It was a simple slugfest. The inexperience on both sides really showed, and the loss of life that came out of it, it was just hit you. One way of thinking of it is, you know, you've got trained martial artist or boxer who's really skilled in pugilistic training compared to a barroom brawl. And this was not the former. This was very much the latter. And from there, Jim, I want to go ahead and pass it back to you for some quotes.
All right. And I'll go ahead and start out. My quote is from chapter 34, a conversation between Victor, Jeremy, Yana, Barry, Ruth, Anton, and Webb concerning going to Mesa. He, Anton, chuckled softly. I will say, Victor, if you pull this off, you have raised the bar of chutzpah about a meter. Who's chutzpah? Asked Barry. Miguel chutzpah, said Ruth, spelled with a J, not an H. He's a leader of the Renaissance League, one of Jessica Stein's close advisors. Webb Duhavel smiled. I think Anton's actually using a Yiddish term, Ruth. What's ancient dialect of German used by Jews? Chutzpah actually starts with a CH, means his eyes got a little unfocused. there's no exact translation. It's a wonderful term, really. The closest would be brazen, brash, but with the connotation of breathtaking self-righteousness as well. A good illustration is the old joke about the man who murdered his parents for the inheritance and then, when caught and convicted, argued that he should get a light sentence because he'd been deprived of parental guidance. That's chutzpah.
Sadly, I was living in California at the time of the Hernandez trials. That actually was in their defense.
Oh, hey. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Hey, JP.
They bring up the possible historic person that, you know, like Miguel Chutzpah. I'm going to highlight our character that we mentioned briefly as we were running through the show, Patrick Henry Van Hale. You know, as always, it seems when David names somebody after a historic person, there's a reason for it. And so We're introduced to this character, Patrick Henry Van Hale. I'm going to give you this quote and then point out where David was going with this, I believe. Patrick Henry Van Hale had married a niece of the Manticoran captain whose ship had intercepted the slaver he'd been aboard. And despite the fact that Patrick had been young enough to receive first-generation prolong after he was freed, he'd still had the perspective of manpower's normally short-lived slaves. Patrick Henry Van Hale also remembered being a slave, and he'd been designed as a pleasure slave, even though he'd been only around 19 years old when he'd been freed. He'd already undergone the full gamut of what manpower euphemistically called training. Lydia Van Hale hadn't, but she'd been the one who'd spent years helping him deal with and survive the dehumanizing trauma of that experience. In ways they would never be able to escape, Patrick's slavery still defined who both of them were, and it was an experience Judson had never shared. They'd never harped on that, never indulged in the, if only I had it as good as you do, school of child rearing, yet he'd become only increasingly aware of that difference between them as he'd grown older. And as he'd also become increasingly aware of the lifetime scars they both carried with them from his father's experience, his hatred for manpower and all things Mason had only grown. So Patrick Henry is a U.S. founding father, you know, from, and you can look up all kinds of good stuff about him. This little nugget came from history.com. In March of 1775, the second Virginian, those of you who are like, yeah, Patrick Henry, I remember learning about him and I don't remember what the big deal was. You're going to get it here. It's a cool little nugget. March of 1775, the second Virginia Convention met at St. John's Church in Richmond to discuss the state's strategy against the British. It was here that Patrick Henry delivered his most famous speech. And here it is. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand here idle? Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. And that's the statement that people tend to remember. Give me liberty or give me death.
Yep.
George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and five of the six other Virginians who would later sign the Declaration of Independence were in attendance that day. And historians say that Henry's liberty or death speech helped convince those in attendance to begin preparing Virginia troops for the war against Great Britain. The connection is that aspect. We're not talking about slavery in the sense we've usually talked about it in this story in the Honorverse, but when he talks about, is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. So this guy had a view of what it meant to be enslaved that fueled the American Revolution. And so I think it's really cool that David picks this character out who was a slave, and the name that he carries with him is Patrick Henry Van Hale.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really neat.
So yeah.
That was my quote and a little history in the middle.
I agree. I thoroughly love to see those names that I recognize like that. And it's like, ooh, oh boy. And then I dig into it a little bit.
I don't know how David did all this homework, because a lot of these books, I mean, we're reading them one after another. A lot of these books, that there, while there were gaps between them, there weren't huge gaps. Some of these, man, his ability to do the homework and the research and weave stuff in that I'm not sure I'd be smart enough to go, you know what we ought to do is find a character that I want to name this guy Patrick Henry. And I mean, the stuff that occurs to him as he has woven the universe together, this Honorverse, is really neat.
I suspect it's very simply this. While he sat in history classes in high school with a whole bunch of other people, while they were talking back and forth with each other, he was paying attention.
Yes. I suspect so. And he is a historian, so he's fond of the history.
Yeah.
But
okay. I've got three quotes here. First one is a flashback to book before last. Honor's one appearance in this book. Honor leaned back slightly, gazing at him thoughtfully. It was obvious from his emotions that he had no idea she could actually taste him. And it was equally obvious he was telling the truth. Just as it was obvious that he actually expected to be detained, probably jailed. And Officer Kasha, she said, I really wish you would deactivate whatever suicide device you have in your right hip pocket. Kasha stiffened, eyes widening in the first sign of genuine shock he'd given. And Anna raised her right hand quickly as she heard the snapping whisper of Spencer Hawk's pulser coming out of its holster. Calmly, Spencer, she told the young man, who had replaced Andrew La Follette, never looking away from Kasha himself. Calmly. Officer Kasha doesn't want to hurt anyone else. But I'd feel much more comfortable if you weren't quite so ready to kill yourself, Officer Kasha. It's rather hard to concentrate on what someone's telling you when you're wondering whether or not he's going to poison himself or blow both of you up at the end of the next sentence. Kasha sat very, very still. Then he snorted, a harsh, abrupt sound, nonetheless edged with genuine humor, and looked at Zilwicky. I owe you a case of beer, Anton. Told you so, Zilwicky shrugged. And now, Mr. Super Secret Agent, would you please turn that damn thing off? Ruth and Barry would both murder me if I let you kill yourself, and I don't even want to think about what Thandi would do to me. Coward. Kasha looked back at Honor, head cocked slightly to one side, then smiled a bit crookedly. I've heard a great deal about you, Duchess Harrington. We have extensive dossiers on you, and I know Admiral Tiesman and Admiral Foraker both think highly of you. If you're prepared to give me your word, not the word of a Manticoran aristocrat or an officer in the Manticoran Navy, but Honor Harrington's word, that you won't detain me or attempt to force information out of me, I'll disarm my advice.
Yeah.
I'll disarm my device. His advice is always disarming. Yeah, I think I might have mentioned that I would have a quote from this scene coming up sometime in the future. I might have mentioned that. I don't remember if I did it back on At All Costs. This was the point. My next quote comes out of the banter you've liked so much. And like I said, I don't dislike it. It's just, some of it, especially the who did this sort of, got a little overdone. So this was when the torches, and by the way, torches is the term that they apply to themselves, the people of Torch. This is when the torches are planning their infiltration. Victor and Anton are taking different vectors into Mesa, and they're having to plan how they're going to meet up. How will you arrange to meet each other after you've gotten there? Asked de Havel. Then he held up his hand. Sorry, I don't really need to know that. I'm just curious. Anton shrugged. We couldn't tell you anyway, since we haven't figured it out ourselves. And won't. I'm just leaving it to Victor to find me. That's because his cover story is riskier than mine and has the advantage of giving him greater freedom of movement if it works. A lot of this is stuff we'll jury-rig as we go along. A number of frowns appeared. Relax, said Victor. We're really good at this. that was a real laugh out loud for me.
I remember that was another choice that that was one I highlighted.
This was one of the ones if it was used, I would have said, oh, dang, someone else got it. The last goes back to the themes that we were talking about. And this is Jack McBride, part of his internal struggle as he's coming face to face with all the grand noble words mean in real application. It's not about the advantages, about the nobility of our purpose, assuming the board truly remembers what that purpose once was, he thought. Those things still matter, but so does your soul, Jack. So does the moral responsibility. There's right and there's wrong, and there's the choice between them, and that's part of the human race's heritage too. And it's about the fact that if we're really right, if Leonard Detweiler was really right about how the entire species can choose to improve and uplift itself, then why haven't we committed even a fraction of the resources we've committed to building the alignment to convincing the rest of the galaxy of that? Maybe it wouldn't have been easy, especially after the final war. And maybe it would have taken generations, centuries, to make any progress. But the alignment's already invested all of those generations and all of those centuries in a grand and glorious vision. And it had abandoned the idea of convincing other people that we were right in favor of killing however many of them it took to make them admit we were right almost before Leonard Detweiler's brain function ceased. For that matter, the way we've embraced and used manpower and genetic slavery has actually contributed to the prejudice against genies. Damn it. It kind of brings that second theme of JP's into context. But that really brings that theme into a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And well, and it shows that I think that's one of the things that shows we're going to get more.
Oh, yes.
On this. And yes, it's going to get harder and harder to wrestle with. All right, guys. How about closing thoughts and takeaways?
Okay.
Jim?
That sounds good.
Yeah. As I mentioned earlier, this was a hard book for me to focus on. There was just too much back and forth between a huge list of characters. I had a difficult time keeping many of the less prominent characters straight in what they were about. And Raul, you suggested that I not worry about the character names and focus more on their roles. And for me, that's kind of difficult because I see a named character, I want to know why I should care about them, and they need some development. I don't have any idea who most of them are or why I should care about them, so it kind of tainted the story for me. It's just my opinion that I am in no way disparaging the authors when I say the book could have been about 200 pages shorter, okay? I enjoyed the character development of the more prominent characters. I might even begin to like Victor Kasha. I think we're going in that direction anyway. I think we might be seeing a transformation taking place where he is concerned, and those are always fun. The Battle of Torch was a slow one in developing, but once it got going, it was an amazing win for the underdogs. That tiny force from the SLN took on a far superior force and handed them their patooties on a platter. I saw that coming as I read the PNE's commanding officer's arrogance. I mean, geez, the guy was just, don't even have to worry about these guys. Okay. That leads me to my takeaway, which is arrogance is never a replacement for experience.
And Jim, that is such a good takeaway. I got to point out something about it.
Yeah.
Translate that from this battle to the Solarian League Navy, in particular, battle fleet.
Oh,
Their interaction with the bigger picture.
Yeah. I thought you were going to tell me to translate it into Russian, and it's like, no way.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we talked about that last time a little bit, right? As I recall, we did anyway.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, the inertia that gathers old school and new school or young school.
Let's just say it's a good thing that there's a D, an I, and an E in the word dime.
Yeah.
Because with the disparities in the militaries, if there weren't, it'd get it, the second half would be very boring. Mm. And fortunately, it's not. There is the other parts of the model.
Yeah. So, JP, how about your closing thoughts?
For me, this, like you again, there was a lot in the book. Reading it was like being on the receiving end of a shotgun blast in some ways. And
I like
that. I liked it. I truly liked it. But I'm glad we're moving on to the next book. Raul.
I agree. There is a lot here and there is a lot to decompress in the book. Some parts were a little bit harder reads, but for the right reasons. In particular, like the slavery themes and the final hard defense of Torch. But there were some other parts that I found a little bit annoying, kind of for the wrong reasons. Some of the silliness aspects, not all of it by far. In fact, one of my quotes represents that. And I'm talking about silliness, not necessarily the banter. Didn't fly, you know, especially like the who is fill in the blank gag gets a little overused, for example.
Oh, that was my quote.
Yeah, that was all, but that was like the first one and it kept getting used. Now, in some ways, as a whole, this book serves as Jim's friend Murray. It is setting up a lot of things. It's a lot of the exposition for what's going to be happening going forward. And both you and Jim and JP have kind of noted that you're suspecting that. Well, it's not a spoiler to say, because we've read enough of David Weber's writings at this point, it's not really a spoiler to say that that's probably an astute observation. Mm. And again, like I said, it is not a bad book by any record. I can understand how it can be a bit of a letdown for someone after the last three books, though. It does a whole lot of stage setting with respect to the alignment and the league. And I will tell you this, when you have the entire story behind you, when you decide, okay, I'm going to invest the time to do a binge reread of the entire saga, this book reads a whole lot better once you've actually read the series.
Well, see, now I got to wonder, though. I mean, what about those like yourself who had to wait a couple of years between books?
Oh, God, I was right. I was, all right. I wouldn't have rated the book quite as high as you guys did, but I wouldn't have abandoned the series because of it. I would have just been annoyed, a little bit upset, and wondering what the heck happened here. And then I'd hit Mission of Honor and I understand a little better now.
I'm home again.
Yep.
All right.
So from there, in fact, let's go ahead and take the ratings of the book. And Jim, I'm going to expand a little bit when I give my score, but I want to get yours first.
Okay. I am giving this 3 hormonal teenage boys. How about you, JP?
Those poor boys. I'm going to give it 3 nasty Detweilers.
Rather than Rottweilers?
They're worse than Rottweilers. And I'm not saying Rottweilers are bad. I'm saying Detweilers are bad.
Okay. And this goes back to the second half of what I had told you, Jim. On my first read, the first time I read it, without the whole context of everything that comes after, I might have given it a 2.5. I might have out of 5. So dead center, 5 divided by 2. I'm going to give it 4 Seki districts, though.
Mm-hmm. All right.
With the caveat that I'm doing this only because I know everything that's coming. I've seen the result of all the setup.
Ah. Well, overall, that gives us a rating of 3.33. And if we look at other ratings, Goodreads has 4,809 ratings at 4.13, and Amazon reports a 4.5 with 1,260 ratings. So we are...
That doesn't surprise me, first of all, because I know this book was liked by a lot of people, which means we're probably going to get some yes, but feedback. That's all right.
Yeah. Oh, well. And
which I encourage. I look forward to.
That's cool. So we have some shout outs. I think I'll go ahead and go through, and if either one of you have any to add, we are getting some great discussions on the Facebook pages, thanks to Rob Shaw Fuller, Rhonda Ward Tech, Jeff Whistler, John Zuloff, Sam Denberg, Mark Singer, and Carl Hommel for your comments and encouragement. How about you, Raul? Do you have any extra shout outs?
Well, it's only been a week since I gave my last group of shout outs. I will say I have kind of caught up a little bit on the Facebook page and have had started tossing in a few more thoughts.
Okay.
So I think you've got it. Unfortunately, yeah, there's in the week's time, and the new show isn't going to go live until a few days after this recording itself. Mm-hmm. So I will definitely be having more feedback from the emails and Reddit later.
Okay. JP, did you have any?
I do not.
Well, then I have one more, and that would be to Mr. Hank Davis, the podcasting machine.
Absolutely.
In charge of the TPE network of fun and informative podcasts. Thanks, Hank. We really do appreciate you.
He's one cool dude.
Yes, he is. And on our next very exciting episode of the Honorverse today, we'll be returning to the main sequence story and discussing Mission of Honor, Honor Harrington Book 12, where Honor sees bad times coming as Manticore and the Solarian League move ever closer to a shooting war. So that's that's our show. Yep. Say goodnight, JP.
Goodnight, JP.
Night, everyone. Had a blast. As always.
So long, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Honorverse today. We welcome your feedback. Email us at honorverse@tpenetwork.com. We are a proud part of TPE Network. Visit us on the web at honorverse.net. on social media, or tpenetwork.com. You can subscribe to Honorverse today by visiting tpenetwork.com/subscribe. Visit TPE Network for the very best in podcasting. Opinions expressed in the show are solely those of the hosts. They do not reflect the opinions or views of Bain Books, the authors, or TPE Network. Visit Bain.com for the best in science fiction. Many of their books are available from the Bain Free Library found at their site. Theme music is Honor and Sword by Zakhar Valaha. Check his website found in the show notes for all your podcasting music needs.
Yes, and now we have an outtake.
Damn it.